Hey everyone, this is Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal, and this is the Fretboard Journal's 89th podcast, and this week is a fun one. I am talking to Anthony Payne, all the way down in Australia, of Harvester Guitars. And Harvester, if you have not heard of them, are creating very cool, one-of-a-kind guitars that are inspired deeply by the guitars of Wandre, the Travis Bean guitars of the 60s and 70s. They are very cool, often aluminum-necked designs, and it was great to talk to Anthony and hear a little bit more about his process. I'll be honest, I've never touched one of these guitars. I've only seen his Facebook and Instagram feeds, but the guitars were so interesting and so unique that it was I wanted to hear more about them. So that's the genesis of this phone call. Lastly, in less than 2 months, the Fretboard Summit is taking place between San Francisco and Santa Cruz at the Costa Noah Resort in Pescadero, California. This is going to be a incredible weekend for guitarists. We have the most insane lineup of musicians I've ever seen in one place, including David Crosby, Bill Frisell, Brian Sutton, Matt Munisteri, Joe Henry, many others. We have speakers including Bill Collings, Paul Reed Smith, Dick Boak from Martin Guitars, Dana Bourgeois, Richard Hoover from Santa Cruz, and many others. And so it's going to be equal parts TED Talks by day, music festival by night. We'll have some jamming. We have some very cool interactive exhibits. We will have free on-site music clinics from Peghead Nation. And the whole thing is just going to be mind-bogglingly cool. Fretboardsummit.com is where you can get tickets. We're limiting the attendance to around 500 people. We want this to be a very cool, intimate place where you can horse trade guitars and talk instruments with fellow fanatics. And we're going to be filming a lot of highlights and sharing those on fretboardjournal.com over the next year or so. So by all means, if you have any means to get near the Bay Area and have any interest in attending this thing, drop us a line, buy a ticket if you can. We'd love to see you there, fretboardsummit.com. Fretboard Journal 34 has Blake Mills on the cover. It's in stores now. It's also available on our site at fretboardjournal.com. So check that out as well. Here is Anthony Payne down in Australia. So Anthony, I, like a lot of people, I imagine, found out about you through the magic of Instagram. And Instagram, as you know, has this huge guitar following about it. How did you get started building guitars?
My father is a woodworker. So I grew up in a house where downstairs there was a workshop, and it was full of lovely, dangerous power tools and chemicals. And Dad was a French polisher primarily. So I learned, from the outside in, something about furniture and working with wood and working with tools. And as a musician throughout my 20s, I kind of learned how to fix my own things. I think it's a pretty familiar story. It's not a unique story. I didn't set out to reinvent any I sometimes hear people say they wanted to create the ultimate guitar or fix some problem they perceived with their own instruments. I was fascinated and marveled at the beauty of some of the old instruments I owned, and I wanted to know how to keep them going and keep them in tune. So I think if you combine those two fascinations with a degree in design and illustration and graphic design, mm-hmm. a fascination with visual design, 20th century history of design, that adds up to what I do now, and somehow it became my full-time job probably 3 or 4 years ago.
At what point in this journey did you stumble upon these sort of exotic Italian guitars of the 60s and 70s that are pretty hard to find here in the States? I imagine they're even harder to find in Australia.
They're non-existent. Yeah, there are some here. I know of a few that have appeared via Japan, which makes sense if you know the Japanese fascination for those kinds of things. There was a book, Tony Bacon's Ultimate Guitar Book, which was in my local library when I was a teenager, I guess. And that book has one Dray guitar in it. And it's sandwiched in amongst all the Hagstroms and the other Eurotrash guitars
sure.
that now do have a following. But at the time, Australia does have a lot of Italian guitars that were imported in the 60s, the sort of the sparkly accordion factory variety, the Crucinellis and Echos. So I did have a few of those. You could buy them for $80 when a Stratocaster cost $800. So I ended up with a bunch of these things. The Wandre was the ultimate. I only recently bought one, mostly so I could pull it apart and see how it works. And, they're fascinating. Fascinating. It's all tied together in that sort of history lesson for me, because it's this Italian post-war explosion of a great design in architecture and use of different materials, the way they used concrete in their buildings, the way they use aluminium in virtually anything, making boats, motorcycles.
And you obviously, you went to university to become a graphic designer, an illustrator?
Yes, many years ago.
Yeah. and did you do that for many years? Or
I never worked in that field directly. I've designed typefaces and designed a lot of flyers and posters for the bands that yeah. I played in. But no, I never worked professionally as a designer. I've just worked in various jobs in universities and libraries. I've been surrounded by books my entire life, so that lends a certain I guess before the internet was around, I was devouring every book about the making of things, whether it was guitars or furniture or the history of the making of cars and bridges, engineering, as a layperson, not as an engineer, but learning. I don't know, I could devour all these books and take something away from it. And a lot of it was to do with the materials and the way they interact and in a sculptural kind of way. And then, of course, the internet yeah. multiplies that by a thousand. And I think by that stage I already was set in some direction here we are.
Yeah. Well, talk to me a little bit. I mean, most guitar makers, let's be honest, electric guitar makers are doing Fender and Gibson copies. And you are using, you know, when you speak of materials, you know, between the Travis Bean necks that you're replicating with aluminum and some of the stuff that appeared in these Wandre guitars, I'm just wondering, has that been a big challenge to kind of replicate these old, you know, crazy materials and put them into a guitar form?
So I guess I was setting myself a challenge. exactly. At the same time, I was making cookie cutter Telecasters and Jazzmasters. I probably have the same admiration and genuine interest in what Leo Fender and B.A. Bixby and all these guys were doing at the time. But I set myself a challenge. Part of that challenge was to not give the world another boring guitar. There's some mercenary streak of some kind of logic there that the world doesn't need another guy making great Telecasters or aged, relict, exact replicas of Jazzmasters or whatever it is.
Sure.
All of that is still in what I do, though. I still do. I love a good relic finish. I love picking up a Jazzmaster. I love all that. But part of it, maybe there's a musical analogy as playing in bands. When I was starting out, I was playing in bands half the week, and you either want to start a covers band and sound exactly like your idol, or maybe you want to you don't want to sound like anyone in the world, and it can lead to musical disaster. Or perhaps business suicide. But that's kind of the way my brain works, I think. There was one foot still in the idea that, yeah, I'm going to have to sell these things. But I was probably reaching for some path that no one had really tried. And it fit with all of what I've just said about my history of learning design and devouring the 20th century of industrial design and sort of regurgitating it into something a bit unique, I suppose.
So how many of these European-inspired guitars have you been able to make so far?
The numbers aren't great. I mean, my total output of guitars, I'm up into serial numbers in the 70s now. I haven't made that many instruments out there. So of that, about a dozen would be the metal necks.
Yeah.
I think. And they're time consuming. I work with an engineer who mills some of the metal parts for me. I work with a welder, a TIG welder, who attaches parts to each other. So in those cases, I live in a sort of industrial part of Melbourne in Australia. Yeah. And I can sort of walk into a big engineering tool shop and I'll be the guy that comes around on the Friday and has a handful of crazy looking Salvador Dali guitar necks and asking them to weld them together in between. They'll be making wheels for those trucks that work in big mining operations that are sort of as big as a house. And they'll sort of, people are fascinated when you walk in with these things. And anyway, suffice to say, it takes a lot of time. I do these in batches and I work with people who have these skills. I have orders for many more currently. So I'm in the middle of a big batch of these aluminium neck guitars. They keep me busy. It's a constant. There's a engineering hurdle in every one. There's always some little geometric puzzle to put together as I try different bodies and different shapes and different headstocks.
Well, I'm curious, now that you are the owner of a Wandre guitar, how did the construction differ from how you may have thought it was going to be before you had hands-on time with one?
Ah, that's interesting. The one that I own is missing a few parts. I've never strung it up and played it. That's probably not unusual. These things are bought and sold as artifacts and they hang on someone's wall for decades and they get traded. And I know the trade in Wandre guitars is not so much about playing them. I think that's borne out in how few of them you see on stages or on the almighty internet. It's pretty hard to find someone playing one, apart from obvious exceptions. The question, yes. My guitars definitely have more of a Travis Bean heft to them. The neck, the core of the neck is solid on mine. It's a hollowed extrusion on the original Wandres. So he was working in a time where these factories, I imagine, were able to just reproduce. He would just come up with a new die, a new shape for the extrusion. And if I wanted to do that, I would need to be ordering five or six figures of dollars of product. And I needed to find a way to mill the materials to fit the shape I needed. And at the same time, I found out that I could make an instrument which has the geometry and the beautiful weirdness and the sort of skeletal look of the Wandre, but because I'm using a more solid, very hardened aluminium for this spine of the guitar, mine have more of a sound and a output, more like the Travis Bean or the EGC guitars. So the Wandres, I've played many of them in my travels, and yeah, they have a lovely a flimsiness to them, and a sort of a hollowness, almost a dobro sort of sound that you can get out of them, which is how they work so well with, say, Buddy Miller's work. And so my guitars, that is in there, especially when you have a combination of pickups at the same time, and you get that sort of shimmering sort of hollowness. But they also have the big sustain of the Travis Bean design in there to some percentage. And so another thing I set out to do was to make the experience a little better for the player's left hand. So my guitar necks, the left hand, you pretty much run up and down a rosewood or padauk wood form, which the metal is then set, milled into and set into. So you don't have the feeling of just picking up a cold metal neck that sort of fills your hand as the Travis Bean does. It's a inert, freezing sort of lump of metal. Mm-hmm. So mine's, it has, that brings it back more to the traditional feel of a guitar, which I like. I've owned and played a Travis Bean for over 20 years, and you know, when you pick it up, it's not the sort of guitar you're going to use to get a mellow sort of sound, a pliable sort of sound where you can bend the instrument to your will or squeeze feedback out of it. It's difficult to sort of play it in that sort of organic fashion that you can, say, with a wooden SG or one of my other old vintage guitars. So I wanted to get something that had a bit more wood, a bit less metal. And the Wandres are at the other extreme of that. They have this sort of hollowness and a lightness of touch that the originals have, that my guitars have sacrificed some of that for some features like tuning stability and rigidity and sustain, definitely heading more to sustain territory. Hope that answers your question.
Yeah, how thick is the wood on these necks?
I guess a visual medium would help here. It's kind of like a regular fretboard at the top of the neck. But it wraps around there's a sort of a keyhole shape routed into the back of the wooden component of the neck, and the semicircular section, it's epoxied and bolted in there. So it's held, it's pretty much like a regular thickness of a fretboard, as you would find on a Travis Bean guitar. Except in my case, it wraps around the sides of the metal component. So it gives the neck a wooden sort of shoulder, I would call it, which I find the hand, with most people's playing styles, the hand sort of runs up and down that wooden component, which is sort of oiled rosewood in this case. And the unusual, there's a sort of a compound radius of, there's the semicircular curve. When you look at the back of the neck, it looks quite alarming to some people, and it's not until I actually put the guitar in their hands that it's pretty soon forgotten, most people's playing styles. Just the interactions of those curves with the human hand, it's always interesting to watch. But generally people, it feels quite regular, quite normal, much more normal than it looks. The look of it is quite alarming to some people, the back of the neck, as are the originals. They're bizarre to behold.
And how much do these guitars weigh?
They weigh generally around 8 pounds in your terminology.
Yeah.
Somewhere between 8 and 9. If I start throwing mastery tremolos and 3 pickups on there, it gets up to about 9 pounds. My Travis Bean guitar is over 10.5 pounds. And so I'm somewhere in between what would be familiar to a lot of my customers from my repair work, something like a Japanese-made Jazzmaster, and just a little heavier than that. It depends on how they're spec'd, what parts, and whether I'm hollowing out the body. Some of the bodies are semi-hollow. Some have a wooden headstock with metal components. Some have an all-metal headstock. So there's always a point in the build where, because they're generally one-off custom designs, there's a point where I have to look at the balance and where I put the strap pins and where I hollow the wood and where I leave it solid to get the right balance. I hate neck dive guitars, and for someone making metal neck guitars, that's probably a good way to be. You don't want to hand a guitar to someone and it hits them in the foot. No.
Well, I was also wondering about pricing, because your pricing for a handmade Australian guitar doesn't seem that high on your website. How much does this aluminum neck add to that price?
Well, I may be undercharging for mine. But another thing, what it adds to the price for me is probably $400 or $500 of price on my site. But an interesting thing is all my sales at the moment are going to America and Europe, where my prices look even better. At the moment, the Australian dollar is falling, and it makes my parts bills high when I talk to my pickup winders in the States. But I'm probably due for a price rise, Jason. It adds, in my mind, it adds a lot of time to the build, coordinating the batches of parts that have to be welded and machined. And so it adds months of time to the build. The working with these materials isn't much harder than carving a neck from wood, or and then having to polish and lacquer and buff and retouch. And there's a point where once the metal work is done, the neck is virtually finished. Whereas the wooden neck, it's in that ongoing process of being finished and polished. And they do add some time. And I'm at a point where they are very time consuming, these things, and they may become more of a split between the prices of my wooden, more conventional guitars and these aluminium ones. Mm-hmm. We'll see. To me, they're still in an early stage. They're still there's not that many of them out there. So,
well, what is the on the aluminium neck guitars? What is the How are they mounted to the body, and I guess what are your preferred what is the body usually made out of?
They are a through neck system. If you look at the amazing Fetish Guitars website, fetishguitars.com, run by my friend Stefano in Italy, you look at the way the originals are built, there's it's a through neck, but there's always some form of attachment from the neck joins onto another component of metal that goes into the body. And I call it the spine, for obvious reasons. And that spine, in my case, is attached to the neck with machine screws. They're stainless steel bolts, basically. And there's a bit of over-engineering at that point. There's an overlap of the two pieces of metal. And I want a very firm joint at that point, for obvious reasons. So there's the neck overlaps the body of the guitar, and there's basically six stainless steel bolts. So it's a bolt-on neck, virtually. But what it bolts onto is more of the same hardened aluminium. which then continues down. And I always, in all the various designs, I always have the bridge attached to the spine as well, so that you get that pedal steel sort of Travis Bean continuity. A lot of the Wondre designs, especially his later export ones, the neck will be metal, but the body, from there on, the body doesn't really attach to the metal. The bridge just sits on the plywood top of the guitar or the wooden top. And so I part of getting more of that sustain and more of that Travis Bean sound is to always have the bridge and preferably the tailpiece as well bolted to that spine. So that's virtually a working unit that can be strung up, and then it sits into a slot in the body of the guitar. So all of the bodies for these guitars have a routed slot that the assembly fits down into, and from there there's more stainless steel bolts which bolt in from the back of the guitar, and so it's all held. It's held in tension by all these bolts. There's still a bit of flex in the material. Just had to find a point where the assembly was not too heavy and could be held against the body of the wood of the guitar with just the points of fixing with bolts to hold it all just in tension. The bodies are generally made from Queensland maple, which is a wonderful timber. And it's a bit of a mahogany substitute for Australian guitar makers. The maker of acoustic guitars, Maton, is an Australian brand. They have used Queensland maple for their necks for many years. It's getting scarce. It's getting hard to buy. And there are other local species. Australia's pretty short on softwoods, but really rich in quite amazing hardwoods. And of those hardwoods, I'd say most of them are too hard for guitar making. There's a lot of brittle, beautiful to behold, but sort of very hard Australian timbers. Some of them are great for fretboards and little details. But finding Australian hardwoods that just have the right weight, the right sort of power to weight ratio for electric guitars has been fun. So there are other species. There's New Guinea rosewood is a beautiful wood I use a lot. Various others. I've used imported woods, African mahogany. I used to have a very good source for, and that would just give a very Gibson sort of traditional sort of weight body. I use a lot of recycled timbers as well, less on the metal neck guitars. They're more about lacquered sort of shiny perfection, whereas a lot of my wooden guitars I now use recycled remilled timbers.
Yeah, and they're beautiful. So is it safe to say that no two Harvester guitars are alike at this point, or have you latched onto some models?
No, that's true. Even I have some models. I have, especially in the wooden guitars, I love certain shapes, and I'll get requests for more than one, and I'll soon realize that I'm onto something, and I'll end up making five or six of a similar shape. But they are unique. There's some guitar makers who've inspired me in that, which is probably worth mentioning, which is when I was in the US on a visit the early 2000s, the only guitar maker I visited, at that time I wasn't making guitars full-time, was Girl Brand in Tucson, Arizona, Chris Larson. And walking into his little workshop was one of the key inspirations for sort of what I do now, I guess. No two instruments are the same. And you look at his work as a folio of work, and you can see the timeline, and you can see various fascinations that he has borne out in his work, or you can see yeah, it sort of presents like a folio of an artist or a sculptor, and that was mind blowing seeing his workshop and how he works and his approach to materials. Another guy is Ian Schneller in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Specimen guitars, again using unusual materials, and I would think he has his models, but really his guitars are all unique individual machines. Michael Spalt is another one. Spalt Instruments.
Sure.
I don't think there's two of those that are the same. And there's a lot of them. So I like these makers who you can look at their, in this case, I'm looking at their websites because they're in other parts of the world. And you can see their development in every instrument. You can see a different design or at least a different visual component or different materials. I like that. It may make sense for me to make some models and batch them into bigger batches. With the guitars at the moment, I can make batches of four or five or six of a shape, and I'll make a batch of necks, wooden necks. I'll make six at a time. So they do end up in batches of different shapes. And from there, I usually leave some parts of the woodwork unfinished, undecided, so that I can choose scale length or dimensions as the customer and I talk about the guitar. And with the metal necks, obviously I make up a batch of the metal components, and I make the bodies in – the bodies are generally based on Wandre's original designs, so there will be the same shape repeated. But even just looking at his designs – there's so many wonderful, bizarre shapes to choose from that if I was to keep politely plundering his designs over the years, I think there would be – you would hardly run out of inspiration just looking at what he's done. And then I tend to bring a lot of them somewhere more towards an electric guitar as we know it in some ways, but keeping some of the Salvador Dali sort of – wackiness there.
Sure. Well, they're amazing. I mean, I'm curious as to how much direction you get from these customers in America and Japan and wherever for these kind of wacky designs that are often hard to describe. Are folks kind of letting you loose and sort of telling you scale, length, and roughly what they're looking for and then getting surprised, or how hands-on are they?
That varies across... And not just my metal neck guitars, but just across what I do. I love the interaction. I love the design process. Sometimes it is just make me a guitar. It's not often, but people will say, I want one of your guitars, and I'll get an email that's virtually one line. And it can be hard to take the person seriously, but they'll pay their deposit, and I'll start talking about ideas, and I'll quote based on what I can see, how much time it's going to take for me, and I'll send them photographs. There's been a few examples lately like this. I'll send photographs, as you see on Instagram or Facebook, or this sort of modern world of this relationship between the maker and the customer, where they sort of see the process as you're working.
Yeah.
They can make comments as we go and updates. Usually this is just done via private email. That's such a luxury. Someone's paying me to basically make a guitar that I want to make. I have to consider what they're going to do with it, and I try and find out a bit about them, how they're going to play it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's evident that they're not going to play it, and I don't mean that in a to judge them, but I honestly sometimes make guitars where you wonder if it's being bought as an instrument or if it's being bought as a sculpture or a a gift for someone, or a sort of a just a someone's fascination with instruments, or their collection of instruments. It's interesting.
It's like the Wandre.
Well, of course, they inspire this. They hang on walls like artworks. It's a funny thing. Yeah. Sometimes people are very specific. More so with my more conventional wooden neck guitars, I think. The metal ones, if someone bites the bullet and sends their deposit and wants one of my metal neck Antonio guitars, they sort of know they're in for a bit of a tangent, a bit of a sort of a process. They're going to be taken along in a different direction with this guitar, because it's unlikely to be like anything they've got. And so therefore they seem quite often less interested in exactly how many millimeters the nut is in width, or you understand, or what pickup specs are in the guitar, because you're not thinking in terms of all those other guitars you've already got, your 60s Gibson versus your 90s Gibson, and the way the millimeters change incrementally over the decades, and all that store of knowledge that all of us guitar nerds have stored away in our brains about these minute dimensions and radii, and all of that information sort of doesn't apply to these crazy things. So when I'm making if I'm making a wooden, a set neck, wooden traditional sort of Gibson style guitar, there'll often be a lot more measurements and specs and widths and things involved in the emails.
Sure, there's a template people expect.
Exactly. There's a history there, an unbroken history of the development of a wooden necked electric guitar, that you have expectations of what it's going to feel like when you pick it up, and I think that's the difference, definitely. Yeah.
Well, I know you need to start your work day. I have one more question, which is just how big has Instagram been as a sort of marketing vehicle of your work as a luthier, and as also just a, you know, inspiration?
To be frank, I don't have it set to show me other people's work very much. And I think I've only just joined Instagram this year. And I think the visual aspect of it really suits my work. I think people I know who I do follow on Instagram generally are photographers and painters and friends, working in a visual medium. I think Instagram has its strengths there. I think to really look at this world, this wacky world of social media, and how it applies to a very small business like mine, Facebook has been, I've had a lot of sales through these social media outlets, and Facebook is a sort of a, your work is swamped in a morass of tacky advertising and videos that you want to quickly scroll past before you see what happens to the person. And, so there's a Facebook seems to be like scrolling through a television, changing channels, and just seeing a whole lot of irrelevant material. And my customers who do genuinely follow me and have followed my work, on a daily basis, a few have said, "Oh, look, you're getting a bit lost here. You're lost in the algorithm." I think it's true, and they suggest that I use Instagram as well as my own website, which is very visual. It's just set up like a gallery of pictures. That seems to suit Instagram. It's just, I think that I don't have to explain, despite the fact that I've sat here for half an hour trying to explain to you the ins and outs of these designs, if you show someone a picture of it, yeah, you pretty quickly grasp what's going on, and that's how Instagram works, I think. You just see a picture, you like it, it's this banal, inane sort of world we live in. But yeah, the viral, the sort of cascading growth of that following is pretty fascinating. And it does lead to sales. I do get sales through Instagram. Sure. Definitely. Yeah, I think it's just that visual snapshot suits my work. If you take a snapshot of the very beautifully replicated Telecaster that you're building, if you're someone else, it's going to come up on a screen on a phone or a computer, and it's going to look just like a Telecaster that you've seen 1,000 times in your life, I suppose. But if something is a bit more visually interesting or a bit more originally designed, you can see in an instant when it pops up.
That was exactly what I was thinking. I mean, I think a lot of guitar people, myself included, have an Instagram feed of basically guitar porn, for lack of a better word. And your designs certainly stand out.
Yes. Oh, I guess that's it. Yeah. I look at my the people who follow me, and a lot of their second names are guitars. So there's, you know, Joe's guitars, Steve's guitars. You know, there's people all around the world doing this. And yeah, it's interesting. It is interesting.
Well, thank you so much, Anthony. I know you got to go build some guitars, but
it's a nice day for spraying lacquer, Jason. So yes,
yeah, spring. You gotta jump into that.
Spring has sprung in Melbourne.